Do you want to change the batteries first?
All right, you're good. All right, I'm Tarek. I'm an addict and alcoholic. Hey, we're on page 64. We're about to find out why it is we write inventory. It's not about changing the way we feel or managing our lives. The book gives you a very clear idea of why. On the top of 64, it says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us from ourselves, from others, and from God. Drugs and alcohol were but symptoms, so we have to get down to causes and conditions. Bottom of page 64 begins the instruction process. It says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more addicts and alcoholics than anything. And I love the word. The word destroy has a great deal of descriptive value for me. And the question is, do you think these resentments you have do have the power to destroy you? From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual maladies overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with the resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We ask ourselves why we were angry. Those are the instructions of the first two columns. When I'm giving instructions out, I say, look, here's the deal. You're going to, if it's someone that's new to the process, I'm going to say, look, put the timer on an hour, and I just want you to start from right now and work your way back. And whatever comes, comes. When the well runs dry, the well runs dry. When it comes off the end of the pen, you do not question it. You don't try to sit back and say, well, no, maybe I don't have that. No, as soon as it comes off the pen, we're done. And we write for an hour. The process doesn't have to take long. Just make the list. And then you go through, so you have one sheet of paper. At the top you have the person or institution or the principle. That is column one. Column two, just underneath that, why am I angry? And people sometimes, they see this word resentment, and the longer you stay in this process, the harder and harder it is to identify resentment. So I use phrases like, who's let me down, who owes me money, who broke their commitments to me, who easily annoys me. They will all fall on that list. Because I'm not really worried about the name that shows up on the list when I'm working with someone that's been around for a while, because I'm really trying to get to the underlying self-defeating principles that are embedded in that third column. So column one, the person, institution, or principle. Column two is, why am I angry, slighted? Why do I feel like I've been slighted, let down, etc.? Then we go through column three. It says, we asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, we found that it was our self-esteem, pocketbooks, ambitions, our personal relationships, including sets. We were hurt or threatened, so we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations with which had been interfered with? So, there's seven areas of self in that third column. The first one is self-esteem. Now, we write theater of the lie inventory. The book starts with the third step. It says this drama called life. And then it begins talking about the actor and the producer and the director and the scenery. So it's creating this play that we're in. I live in my play. I've got my host of characters. I play the main character. You have your own play. You're the main character in your play. What happens is we get caught up in other people's plays, and we play roles. Throughout the course of the day, I play all these different roles. I have a father. I have a husband. I have a business owner. I have Mr. AA, Mr. CA, the spiritual guru, and I have a few others, right? So why do I end up in a position where I need to write inventory? All right, so the father and the son. Usually the first one that engages the day is the spiritual man, and he's determining whether or not he's going to engage prayer and meditation. And then the father shows up, and then the husband shows up. So In an ideal world, we get to play that one role in that one act in the play, and we do it to the best of our ability, and then we move on to the next one. I go to work, I become the business owner, and I become the program director. But what happens is I have some type of run-in with my wife at work in the morning before I go to work. So she's already got me all twisted up. I get to work, I've brought the husband to work. So not only is the husband at work, the business owner is also at work. And then even a friend shows up, because I'm really good friends with the people that I work with. So let's say I have a run-in at work, you know, with one of the guys I work with, like I did yesterday, and then I move back to being at home with my wife and daughter. So now I have the altercation in the morning, I have the altercation at work, and now I'm showing back up to play the role of husband and father, but I've got the business owners coming home too. And they all have their own set of belief systems about the world and the people in it, and they sometimes conflict with one another. You know, Mr. Spiritual Man wants to live and let live. The business owner wants to be assertive and take control. The husband wants to be very attentive and loving, and he wants to be present for his family, but on his mind is work. And so in an ideal world, I play the one role, and I play that act in the play, and I move on to the next. When you write inventory and you start looking at self-esteem, you're really looking at who's showing up to this one act in the play. So when I write self-esteem, it's how I feel or see myself in this resentment, in this one exchange. That's what self-esteem is. Pride, which is in the example that Bill gives, is how I want others, how I want you to see me in this one act in the play. Ambition, the way I write it, is in the external world, outside of myself, what do I want to have happen in this act right now? And then there's security. Security for me is an internal thing. What do I need? Do I need validation? Do I need respect? Do I need to feel safe? What is it I need in this one act, in this play, to be okay and to breathe? Then there's personal relationships. Personal relationships are my deep-seated belief systems about how this relationship is supposed to work. So if I'm writing about an employee, my idea is about employees. If I'm writing around about my wife, it's my idea about wife. If I'm writing about my friend, it's my idea about what a real friend is. Sometimes the way I show up affects personal relationships as a result of this resentment. So I'll write about that as well. For sex relations, if I'm writing about a man, I have a deep-seated belief about how a man is supposed to show up in this act. If I'm writing about a woman, I have a deep-seated belief about how a woman is supposed to act in this role, in her role in this play. Pocketbook is time and money. When I'm working with a new guy, I walk him through Mr. Brown's example. Now, Mr. Brown is paying attention to Bill's wife. He told Bill's wife about the mistress, and Brown may get his job at the office. Those are three pretty bad things to do, right? To be angry with someone. Bill uses 19 words. So when people write inventory and they're new, I give them 19 words. I don't want them to pontificate that second column. There's just no point. So those are the reasons why they're angry, and I went through the seven areas of self. And the reason I said at the beginning that I start now and go back is the first time I wrote inventory, I tried to go back to my earliest memory. And I sat there, I mean, I was going back through grade school and through high school and every job I ever had and all my family and all my extended family. I don't think that's effective. The book says we went back through our lives. So if I want to go back to that door, I get up from here and walk to the door. I go back. I'm going back through my lives. I start from the present and I go back. And when the well runs dry, the well runs dry. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. So if people always ask me, well, the theater of the lie inventory is not in the big book. Well, the big book tells you to consider it carefully, and that's a really good way to consider carefully. That's where I get that from. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people are often quite wrong. To conclude others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with addicts and alcoholics whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this resentment, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. So it can't just, it's not just grave, it's infinitely grave. It's fatal. So two death sentences back to back. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of crack cocaine returns and I get high again. And for me to get high is to die. Three times they threaten your life in one paragraph. I think they're trying to say that we do not have the luxury to live a resentful life. If we are to live, we have to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for addicts and alcoholics, these things are poison. So, that wraps up the first three columns. Now, the big book in the doctor's opinion says we must have a psychic change. I don't know about you, but I spent my entire life knowing who I was angry at, why I was angry at them, and I could tell you how it affected me. But until I got to the recovery process outlined in this book, I had never, ever, 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 ever,
ever,
ever taken the time to set aside entirely what the other person has done and to resolutely look at my own mistakes and where I had been at fault. That is a new way of thinking. I truly believe that's the start of the psychic change. Now, like with what happened at work yesterday, immediately I have to look for how I'm creating the situation. The trouble has to be of my own making. It must be of my own making. Otherwise, I'm screwed. The reason that statement is the greatest statement of hope in the book is the world and the people in it do not have to change for me to be okay. That's what inventory has to show me over and over. So when I listen to a fifth step, I continually take them back. Do you see how this trouble is of your own making? Do you see how this trouble is of your own making? That's how you get free. We created all of it. Therefore, the solution, that unsuspecting inner resource, the solution is within us as well. So we turn back to this list, for it holds the key to the future. That's what I just described is the reason it's the key to the future. It's the new way of thinking. It's the new way of thinking. We are prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominate us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, has the power to actually kill. How can we escape? We saw these resentments must be mastered, but how? We can't wish them away any more than drugs and alcohol. Earlier in the book, it says, I can't get rid of my selfishness and self-centeredness without God's help. Now they're telling me these resentments are going to kill me, and I can't do a damn thing about it except seek God. I write inventory so I can seek God. The longer I've stayed clean and sober, the more I believe that the spiritual experience is about relationship, that I can only experience this power in relationship. So if I'm blocked from you, I am blocked from God. That's very simple. I truly, truly believe. I think monks cheat existence. I mean, hell, you put me out at a monastery and I'm a sunbeam seeking God all the time. And I am centered and nothing's going to shake me. But you put me in this. Totally different. So for me, for the path I'm on, I am meant to suffer in this existence and struggle through it, but in order to help people overcome their own existence, because I have tapped an unsuspecting inner resource that helps me navigate through this existence with a sense of joy and peace and just contentment. And that's why I'm here. I'm here to help other people get free. So this is our course. We realize that the people who wronged us are perhaps spiritually sick. So when I listen to inventory and we're going from the third to fourth column, I try to remind them, okay, so we have to pray that the people are also spiritually sick. You know, I'm amazed how we treat people like they shouldn't have any defects of character, right? How dare you show up this way? We overlook the defects in other people. We forget that they too are spiritually sick. So if this idea of being driven, you guys are aware of this idea, driven by selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, we step on the toes of our fellows. So if I can become driven, and when I am in a driven state, I don't have any choice other than to go down the path I am on. And so why doesn't this same concept apply to other people? Why do I actually believe that other people choose to actually inflict harm on me. It's not true. It's a delusion. If the principle of being driven applies to me, it must also apply to other people. And when I can see that, and when I can see that they're also blocked and spiritually sick, I can come at them from a place of compassion. Though we don't like their symptoms and the way they disturb us, they, like ourselves, are sick too. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offends us, we say to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." We avoid retaliation or argument. We don't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. These are the specific instructions for column 4, and I want to talk about a piece of watered down AA. I hear it all the time. I'm looking for my part. I'm looking for my part. I got to see my part. Nowhere in the big book is that phraseology used. This is what the book says. I refer back to my list again, putting out of my mind the wrongs others had done. I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? Though a situation has not been entirely my fault, I try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where am I to blame? The inventory was mine, not the others. When I see my faults, I list them. I place them before me in black and white. I admit my wrongs honestly, and I am willing to set these matters straight. Here's why some people say semantics. I disagree. Let's say you're going to make amends, and you've got a part. And I don't know about you, but when I'm claiming parts, my part's always smaller than your part. All right? I show up to make an amends, and I'm there to clean up my part. Naturally, you should clean up your part at the same time, right? That sets us up.
There's your part. There's their part. So he's gonna come and say, "All right, I'm sorry about this. Come on, tell me about yours." That's how we approach it.
It is exactly how we approach it. So when I sponsor men through the steps and I hear them at a meeting say, "I got to see my part," I'm going to have a discussion with them after that meeting. They cannot. I will not sponsor you and you use that language. You're going to set aside entirely what you did and you look for your own mistakes and where you're at fault. That's where you get free. I don't know where, how that snuck into the rooms and the concepts out of the book, but it's not in the big book. And I'm going to share a piece of inventory. And I'm going to do this quick, and Brandon's going to take over and do Fear and Sex. But, I didn't have a relationship with my father for 31 years. My father is a drunk. He abused my brother and I physically, emotionally, verbally. He beat my mom. Both my brother and I got in physical fights, and we beat my dad up when we were in high school. And I didn't want anything to do with him. And so I get to the first time I wrote inventory, and I can't even tell you how many resentments I had towards my father. But I was, and this is going to go into the fifth step a little bit, but I remember going through the inventory process and setting aside everything my dad had done and looking where I was at fault and the fear and the dishonesty and the delusion. You know, he was, you know, I always thought he was a horrible father, but then the guy listening to my fifth step said, "What kind of son were you?" And I was a horrible son. And he'd asked me some questions along when I was reading inventory to him. He said, "Have you ever physically abused anyone?" I said, "Yeah." "Have you ever verbally abused anyone?" I said, "Yeah." "Have you ever emotionally terrorized someone?" I said, "Yes." "Have you ever sat down with your dad and asked him what he went through prior to you being brought into this world and what made him the man that he is?" I said, "Never. I've never taken the time to know anything about my father, from his upbringing or what he went through to make him the man that he is." And my head dropped because I knew what the guy was doing that was listening to my fifth step. He just pointed out to me how clearly I had become my father. And from that point, I had nothing but compassion for my father, because if I had lost the power of choice behind my alcoholism and my addiction, clearly the same principle would apply to him. So I saw how there was no choice in what he did, that he actually did the best that he could. And so for the last 9+ years, I have developed and cultivated a relationship with my father, to the point where now he's battling cancer, and I take him to chemo, and I hang out with him. And, you know, as a result of this program, I've been able to learned things from my father that I never thought were possible. And I truly believe it was from this inventory process of the sick man prayer that I read to you on the bottom of 66 and 67, that he, like me, is spiritually sick too. And I treat him like he's a sick person. And as a result of that, I've grown very close to a man who did some things that were, you know, hurtful. But I saw me in him. And it was because of this inventory process. That's how powerful this process is. Okay?
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. So the first time I wrote inventory, just coming into to recovery, resentments didn't show me a whole lot. I'm a big, tough guy. I didn't have any fears. But the when I got into the sex inventory and saw, and I asked myself the 9 questions, and I went through it, I saw how the way that I treated my relationships with women was the same way that I would show up at work, was the same way I would show up in other relationships, this desire to dominate, this trying to prove my worth, trying to prove that I was good enough, that I had enough, that I was this thing. So that was the first time I wrote inventory. The second time I wrote inventory, resentment showed me all this information about myself that I had no idea what's going on. I saw how the world and its people really dominated me in so many different ways that I was completely blind to. So second time, that time I was about 2 years sober. And about 3.5 years sober, I wrote another piece of inventory, and it turns out, I don't know what happened in 3.5 years, but I am full of fear. And fear dominates every area of my life. I had no knowledge of this. This was new information. And what happened is, as I was starting to write about these, I had these kind of 14 things that I wasn't doing in my life that I was incredibly, that was, I wasn't doing them as a result of the fear that was generated within me. And I did the fear a little bit differently than the way that the book talks about. And I had started writing this inventory out, and I was hardly into the first piece of inventory, and I was just absolutely disgusted with myself. And so I called my sponsor, and I said to him, I'm writing this fear inventory, and I am absolutely disgusted with myself because I'm a complete phony. I have no idea how I could walk around with all this fear and not know that this was going on. And as he does, he goes, okay, well, why are you calling me? I said, because I need you to say something magical so that I can go back and finish writing this inventory. And he said, all right, hold on a second. All right, so why do we write inventory? To face and be rid of the things that are blocking us from God and those about us. He said, okay. So for me, I think of God as like this big excavator, okay? And we were born pure. And over time, judgments and fears and experience of life get stacked up on top of us, and we no longer are pure. We have this kind of layer of dirt that gets between us and the outside. And if you look at an excavator when it's ripping through the earth, he's using construction terms because I'm in construction. He says it looks pretty violent as it kind of tears away at that earth. But in order to do that, you have to get down to the solid foundation of who you really are. And the reason why you're experiencing this discomfort is because it's simply God removing all that dirt between you and the existence of your pure self. And so he pauses for a second and he goes, so how do I do? I was like, that's good enough. I'll go back and finish writing it. But I now see today that I am dominated by fear. The two things that show up the most significantly for me today are pride, that's in the third column of the resentment inventory, and fear. And that I am driven by how I want you to view me, and by the fear of not being perceived the right way, understood, getting what I want, all these things. And so it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, everybody I've ever come in contact with. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. This was news to me, right? So my fear is generated because I'm worried that I'm not going to get what I think I deserve, or that I might actually get what I deserve, right? By doing things wrong. And so I'm in the world to play the role that God assigns me. The things that are showing up in my life are for a learning experience for me to go forward through. But I don't know this stuff. I can't see this because I'm too busy looking at me and what's going on with me. So as I go through the fear inventory and I look at it and I start seeing it, is the amount of freedom that comes from a thoroughly written fear inventory is immense. Even if you don't think you have it, you got it. It's all over you in every action that you do all day long. You just don't see it. And so this paragraph, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality a way of weakness. I'm confident that somebody in this room is looking at us as we've shared what we've shared this weekend and going, these guys are full of it. You're laughing at us. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. They never apologize for God. Instead, they let God demonstrate through them what God can do. And then they got this cool little prayer that I use all the time, except for I modify it by inserting a little bit. We ask God, so there's a prayer. So God, please remove my fear of insert whatever it is and direct my attention to what you would have me be. At once, I commenced to outgrow fear. I use this prayer all the time, and it is crazy, some of the stuff that shows up. Don't have a job. I need a job. I'm sitting there. God, please remove my fear of not having a job. Direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Hey, call this guy about a job. I call that guy, say, hey, do you have a job for me? He's like, I never thought about hiring you before. Let me think about that. Let me find out a way I can use you. The fear prayer is vital in my day-to-day living today. I'm not going to dive into the whole inventory process because, well, it might bore you and we're trying to keep you awake for Lindsay. So, now about sex. Now, there's not a whole lot of sex inventory that comes up for me at 5 years sober. Because I'm not out there. I'm now in a committed relationship. I'm not straying. I have no intention to stray. It's the most magical relationship I've ever been in. I might do some harm to her. I might do some things that I don't like. But for the most part, sex inventory for me today is not about sex inventory. It's about a conduct inventory. It's about my conduct towards other people. And I've heard a lot of people, this is for new people, this is probably the inventory that I think most sponsors just skip over because it might have some uncomfortable stuff. And so a lot of people will write the resentments, a lot of people will write the fear. Well, sex, that's just something that, you know, we don't deal with that. But if that were the case, I'm certain I wouldn't be sober today because of what I learned from the first inventory I wrote. Now, I probably had... And to me, sex inventory is not about pokey pokey. It's about the relationships with the other sex for me and how I show up. There's 9 questions. We reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? The least answered correctly question whom had we hurt? Let's just say that a person was unfaithful and their spouse found out about it. Who did you hurt? Well, I hurt her and me. Really? Does she have any friends? Yeah? Do you think she talked to her friends about you cheating on her? Maybe. So did that impact your relationship with them? Yes. Do you have kids? Yes. Do you think that your kids were impacted either directly or indirectly by what you did? Yes. Do her parents now look at you differently? Yes. Do your parents know about it? Yes. Do you think your parents look at you differently? Yes. So you just hurt you and her, huh? Or maybe the whole planet. Just saying. Did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where were you at fault? What should you have done instead? Okay, so you got this all down on paper. And then another thing that we skip over quite often is this ideal, right? So basically when we go through the sex inventory, we answer those questions, what should I have done instead? Well, I should have been faithful. I should have been honest. I should have been committed to the relationship. So when I have those things, then I get to create this ideal of basically, what should I have done instead? Not what I did. The exact opposite. And then I create this ideal. In this way, I tried to shape the sane and sound ideal for my future relationship life. And then I ask God to mold my ideals and help me live up to them. So, skipping down to the last paragraph, it says, whatever our ideal turns out to be, so that I get this ideal that I around this, what I want my relationship with this woman to look like, I must be willing to grow towards it. I must be willing to make amends where I have done harm, provided that it does not still bring about more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. So, skip over to page 70. One of my favorite paragraphs in the book that you can apply to everything beyond sex ideal. Basically, you can apply it to your life. The first full paragraph. So I've written this ideal about how I want to show up in this relationship with this woman. So if you're somewhat... I know Tarek's done it, I've done it. When I write an ideal, a new ideal, for my relationship with the woman I'm married to, I will share it with her. This is the man I want to be. How am I doing? When I feel ambitious, about every 6 months, I might pull it back out and read it again and say, how am I doing? Give me a little report card. Now, that sounds a little bit insane unless you really want to have that kind of relationship. If you really want to have that kind of relationship, then do it. If you want to just pretend that you want to have that kind of relationship, don't do it because it's kind of painful sometimes. Because you go through it and you're like, how am I doing with your kids? Not good. Okay. I thought I was doing better. Okay. So am I being better about asking about your day? No. Okay. So you start to learn and you use, like everything in this book, you use as a tool to grow deeper in your relationships. If I grow deeper in every relationship I have, I grow deeper with my relationship with God because to me, you're God, I'm God, we're all God. And if that's the case, the deeper I have a relationship with you, the greater I get to experience that power in the universe. So I now have this ideal of how I want to... the guys I sponsor, I have them write ideals about what their recovery is supposed to look like, what their job's supposed to look like, what their relationship's supposed to look like. Usually it's those three, and if they have struggles with some other things, I'll have them write about those. But then we come to this paragraph. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. This is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. So, let's say I stumble and I intend to be faithful, but I'm not. Does it mean I'm going to get drunk? Well, it says, if we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So I'm using this example because it's sex inventory and it's about as extreme. Let's say I am unfaithful to the woman I'm married to. Am I going to go get drunk? Probably not right away. If it was one of those weird mental blank spots and I did it, you know, obviously I've got some work to clean up. But let's say I don't clean it up and I keep having that relationship over and over and over again. Do I really think that I'm not going to suffer in the spiritual sense? Do I really believe that? Because this paragraph here tells me that if I'm not sorry and I keep doing it, if I'm stealing from work and I keep stealing from work, I'm probably going to get drunk, probably going to get high. If I steal from work and I intend to go clean it up, maybe I'll get a pass. I lose my job, but might get a pass. This paragraph, to me, you can apply to so many areas of our lives. And if we skipped over the sex inventory, the idea of writing an ideal for any aspect of our life is lost. And the idea of seeing the consequences of not living up to what I know is right. I mean, everybody in here knows what's right and wrong. We just may try to delude ourselves into thinking that, it's really not that bad. And so, to me, that's where this paragraph comes in.
Thanks, Brandon. There is no point in writing a sane and sound sex ideal unless you're going to refer to it. And so Brandon and I both do this practice, and we both have pretty damn good marriages. I wonder if it's connected with the fact that we actually share our ideal with our partner. So last night I get home from this, and I sit down on the couch, and I immediately get on Facebook. And my wife knows my ideal. This is the ideal from this. I went through the steps earlier this year. And yes, I go back to the first step. I don't go back and just start writing inventory. I have to look at my current unmanageability and how that's connected to my addict. Because all, you know, over 9 years clean and sober, the addict inside of me can't use crack cocaine and whiskey to get at me anymore. He's got to use other things, and it's my unmanageability. And I have to look at my current conception of God, and I look and I mold it. I change it. I look at it. It grows. It's fluid. And then I look at my third step decision. I reaffirm that and see what's going on with the actions in my life and holding up this decision that God is, you know, God is the center of my life. And I go into inventory, and I come up with this ideal. I listen to Marcy with intent and communicate without fear. My actions show her she is appreciated. I continue to value her ideas and thoughts. We deepen our relationship as intimate lovers and best friends. We set aside one night per month for a special evening together. I pull my weight around the house. I thank God for her and Callie every day. I invite her to let me know when I'm not meeting her needs in any of these areas. And so immediately last night when I get on Facebook, she goes, "Look, you're supposed to be showing me attention." But she didn't say that in a selfish way. She knows it's in the ideal. You're supposed to be present and here, and you're not. She has spiritual license with me. She called me out. What good is this part of the step work if you don't share it with another person? Especially the person you're trying to cultivate a relationship with. And then there's this sex inventory. God bless these 9 questions, but I answered them. I've done this a few times, but I answered the 9 questions about God. And this is the reason I love reworking the steps every year, because I'm bringing you guys my most current experience with this process, not a 9-year-old experience. A current experience, a few months old. This is my inventory with God. Selfish. At times I think excessively about myself, and when I'm doing so, I'm not consciously aware of your presence. I don't pray for others as often as I used to. Most of my communication with you centers around things that have to do with my own welfare. Dishonesty. At times I tell people I will pray for them and I don't. I affirm states of being with God, then I do the exact opposite. I tell people I prayed about something, but I didn't. Inconsiderate. At times, I don't adequately consider messages from you before I act. When I practice remembrance, I act as if it's a drudgery or a litany at times. Whom have I hurt? Myself and others when I don't bring my awareness of you into all my decision-making. Have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy? I've been hostile towards you and guarded ideas and possessions that you may be directing me to let go of. Have I unjustifiably caused suspicion? Whenever I don't trust you, doubt you, or blame you when something happens that I believe is wrong. Have I unjustifiably caused bitterness? Whenever I show anger towards you because I believe you've treated me poorly. Where am I at fault? I don't bring the consciousness of your presence into everything I think or do. What should I do instead? Be conscious of your presence in everything I am and everything that I do. Describe in writing more of my experiences with you. That's how I had a current experience. That was probably the most revealing and most meaningful part of the entire inventory process for me, was really examining this relationship that each one of us in this room says is the most important relationship in our life. And so, if God truly is the most important relationship in your life, A, how much time are you spending cultivating that relationship? And are you really looking deep down within to see what your fundamental ideas about God are? And that's what this inventory process can do for you. These pages in this book are 500 feet deep. It's limitless. It's an abyss what you can do with this book. And every time I go through this book, there's a new word. And I didn't see it. Or I see a phrase completely different. So Brandon's going to start us in. We've still got we're going to go until 10 after. And you want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to start us in on 5?
Yeah, how do you want to do this?
Just go.
Yeah. Okay. So we think we have done well enough admitting these things to ourselves. There's little doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. Okay. The experience of... The experience of reading inventory to other people frees me from what has me bonded, what has me blocked, what has me in this place where I can't really see what's going on with me. On page 74, it says, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Person or person, saying that I maybe should share this with more than once. On page 94, it also says, he may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people, implying more than one. I come from a tradition of reading inventory, the same inventory, to multiple people, and I do that for several reasons. Number one, usually the first person to hear my inventory is the guy sitting to my left. And, you know, since he's a friend and he's a spiritual advisor and you know, I help him with his stuff, I can't help it. There's still a part of me that wants to sound good when I read inventory. So I'm going to try to make sure I go to the deep, deep places and share it with him. And I'm as honest as I can be when I'm sharing that with him. And then I share it with somebody else. And then I'm realizing as I'm sharing the inventory with somebody else that, wow, I'm sharing some different things than I shared with Tarek. And then when I share it with the third person, it's, I can't remember exactly how I shared it with Tarek, and I can't remember how I shared it with the second person. So the third person I'm reading it to probably gets the truth. They probably get the raw, this is what's me. Now, I've read the same piece of inventory to multiple people, and it's so weird how I'll share something that somebody else read or commented on my fifth step, and they'll say, well, I don't see it that way, but I see it this way. And I read one piece of inventory to a guy in Indianapolis, and he crushed me with this one. He said, so let me get this straight. You would be okay with giving people average work as long as you got credit for doing the best work. And man, Mike, when you say it that way, it sounds so bad. But yeah, that's exactly what I think. I read that same piece of inventory to somebody else, and he says, man, you are one entitled motherfucker. And I go back, and I'm flipping through the five or six resentments, and I'm like reading through them. I'm like, really? And then it's like, it hits me. It's like, wow, I am very entitled here. And I don't have the ability to see this. I think I'm doing pretty good by just writing this stuff out and sharing exactly what I have written. But what happens over time is as I share the resentment again and again and again, it allows me to sit up here and read inventory to you that I mean, it's who I am. I get it. And the power of a resentment or a fear that I have that it has over me is gone. You know, the realization of reading fear inventory to multiple people is as I was reading some of this inventory, somebody points out, wow, it's weird that, like, the thing that you're the most afraid of by not doing action around the fear is coming true. I don't like to hear that. I'm creating that fear to actually manifest in my life by not addressing the fear. I should probably look at the fear because then I might do something about it. And there's so much freedom that we get through the fifth step. You know, there's another line down here in the middle of page 74. It says, we have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. I do not hear that in most of the meetings I go to. Most of the meetings I go to, people say, don't be so hard on yourself. See, if I'm aiming for perfection and I miss, I'm still going to end up pretty good. If I'm aiming for average and I miss, I might be drunk. So, does it really harm me to read this inventory to multiple people? Does it really harm me to go through and do an inventory on a semi-annual basis? Or does it put me in a position to where I get to be more free? Does it put me in a position to where I can sit up here and read one of the most revealing pieces of inventory that I've ever written? And I don't like it. Every time I read it, I kind of get disturbed with myself because some of this still exists. I still show up the same way with this guy. So this is one of my stepkids, okay? He is incredibly intelligent, one of the most loving and caring people that there is. He wants to be part of my life. He wants me in his life. He tries really, really hard. He's absent-minded. Sometimes he's not trying to harm me. But so I've got this piece of inventory that I've written. I'll leave his name out. But the column two is he's retarded and frustrates me. He's not retarded. There's nothing wrong with him. This is what my judgmental, terrible mind says about him. Self-esteem. I'm the perfect dad, son, human. Pride. Everyone, including all of you, should follow my lead and everything will be fine. Ambition, I want to rule the world. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Security, everyone, including him, should fall in line and do as I think. Important, do as I think. Fulfillment of this need can be satisfied until I change my mind. Personal relations, a real kid acts like an adult. Makes complete sense. Therefore, if he acts like an adult, then my wife might find me more sexy, right? Pocketbook, I waste time. The time I spend watching him fumble is wasted. So fear, if my thoughts, needs, wants, desires are not met, I cannot be happy. I'm dishonest because I have little or no faith that when I say he is on his own path, I actually believe it. Instead, I secretly wish everyone will do as I think and be ready to change direction at a moment's notice, even though I know that my thinking is flawed. I'm selfish because I only care about what goes on in my head. I'm self-seeking because I build walls of arrogance and indifference to generate a feeling of superiority simply as a defense mechanism to protect me from what thinking I know is flawed. I have a sense of arrogance that protects me from being truly authentic with anyone I meet. Then I cry that nobody understands me and walk around in self-pity waiting for the world to change instead of taking the necessary action to improve my life. That's not fun for you guys to know that. But I've read this to enough people that it doesn't have power over me. I realize that I show up this way in a lot of relationships. But isn't it wonderful that we have a mechanism where when I read this to other people and I get their insight, that I can apply it to my life and something happens. Something happens in my life where relationships start to change. I start to become aware of the delusion of the fact that just because I'm thinking it doesn't make it real. Just because I'm thinking that you should show up this way and don't share it with you doesn't mean that you're going to actually show up that way. But that's how I want things to happen. And when I do this, enough times, I get this promise. You know, we read the ninth step promises in the meetings all the time. And they're the ninth step promises because they come as a result of working the ninth step, not as a result of showing up to enough meetings. You actually have to do something. But this fifth step promise, once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel a nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but we now begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on a broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Why wouldn't you want that? Sounds pretty cool to me.
I do multiple fifth steps because I like the effect produced by it. Who in here does anything for any reason other than that? I remember the first time I got introduced to doing this work this way. Multiple fifth steps, and I was convinced it wasn't anywhere in the book, but it says person or persons and closed mouth friends that we seek out. I read a lot of inventory to men I sponsor. I didn't grow up in the first lineage I was a part of did have that mentality of the sponsor is the leader and the sponsees are the followers. And the sponsor can't ever look bad in front of the sponsees. And for whatever reason, that's because of my sponsor and his capacity to be so transparent and authentic and share all his struggles with me. It has given me the capacity to be willing to really show the men I sponsor my limitations as a human and why I must have God in my life. And the way Brandon described the experience of reading inventory and the flawed thinking that he becomes aware of by doing multiple fifth steps, I have got to have that in my life. My life has become an unfolding, eternal fifth step. I'm constantly showing my limitations to others. And I think that's one of the most vital pieces of my spiritual growth over the last few years is this idea that authentic, transparent dialogue between me and the men who walk this path with me is of paramount importance. because of the cunning, baffling feature of the addict that dwells inside of me, and what he uses now at almost 9.5 years of being clean and sober. The alcohol and then the cocaine, it's off the table. There's a cunning, crafty, egoic, unconscious aspect to what's going on inside of me, and this I think it's direct. It has to be connected to the fact that I've spent the last 7 years doing multiple fifth steps, and now when we dialogue, we're constantly fifth stepping with each other. It creates a dynamic in your life that I can't really describe in words of how powerful it is to have that type of communication in your life. I don't hide things. I just don't. There's a lot of stuff that some people I think would go through some things and they keep it close to the vest. But living in an eternal unfolding fifth step keeps you consciously connected to this power. It really does. Because you're not living a double life. You're not showing the world a stage character, and deep down inside you know you have a reputation that you don't deserve. And you can live an honest life that way. I think that's all we're going to do. I think that's all we're going to do for tonight. Tomorrow, we're going to cover 6, 7, and 8, and 9 in the first session, 10 and 11 in the second session, then wrap it up with step 12. We're going to take a 13-minute break. We're going to come back at 6:20, and the amazing Lindsay will close us out with her story.
I'm always fearful that that's going to get back to him. What?
It's a mess. Appreciate y'all.
Thanks, brother.
Because it's just so wrong.
Well, we'll see if he ends up one here. One day he may end up on the fire board.
He's going to have to go back years to find it, though.
We gotta work. We can probably cover all that in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Because I think, 6 and 7, you can hit that, and then.